from Montana to Georgia, Pennsylvania to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States has declined to get involved in state fights over the gerrymandering of congressional districts. Charles Blahaus of the Mercatus Center joins us to explain. Nike has once again bowed to left-wing political pressure, this time dissing Betsy Ross and the first American flag. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. So if you like your dishwasher, you can keep your dishwasher. Not if the U.S. Department of Energy gets its way. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Devin Watkins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And as we celebrate our independence, the nation is politically deeply divided. But a new book extols what could be a restoration of our values. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Admitting a certain amount of partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts is constitutionally acceptable, the Supreme Court of the United States has refused to resolve disputes in two states. Here to talk about the court's decision is Charles Blahaus. He is a senior research strategist at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Charles, welcome to American Radio Journal. Charles, let's begin before we get into what the Supreme Court of the United States decided here a few days back. When we talk about gerrymandering, what exactly does that term mean?
That is a great question, because how you define the term often determines basically how you think about it and how you think about remedies for it. I think most people think of gerrymandering as a practice where legislative mapmakers are drawing very distorted, weirdly shaped congressional districts or legislative districts for the purpose of gaining some type of political advantage. And those are two different concepts, if you think about it. One is drawing very warped, distorted districts, and the other is gaining political advantage. And depending on which part of that you focus on, you arrive at very different opinions about what needs to be done. My view is that gerrymandering is really about drawing very strange shapes and not having districts where people in the same constituency live near one another. But other people who comment on the issue tend to write about it with respect to its partisan effects. And they view gerrymandering reform as more of a partisan balancing act, making sure the different political parties are treated equally and fairly. I think that's the wrong approach for a number of reasons, but those are multiple definitions that are floating around.
And, of course, this is a heated topic because every 10 years we have a census. We're going to have one next year, 2020. After that, the congressional districts will be reallocated among the states, and the states will have to draw new boundaries for congressional districts. So the whole issue is something very pertinent. There have been a couple of cases still left over from the last redrawing of congressional districts that have perked their way up to the Supreme Court. So what was before the court in this past session, and then tell us what the court decided?
There were a couple of cases related to gerrymandering, but the most pertinent ones came up at the very end of the session. And there was a case affecting districting in Maryland and another one having to do with North Carolina. And they were viewed as symmetric cases in a sense, because one of them you had highly gerrymandered maps that favored Democrats, and in the other one you had highly gerrymandered maps, or at least maps perceived to be highly gerrymandered, favoring Republicans. And there was an effort to get the Supreme Court to strike these maps down as unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering. And the Supreme Court declined, basically, to get involved. They basically said, look, it's not for the courts to determine how states draw their legislative districts. There's no clear constitutional standard as to when partisan advantage is excessive. And we shouldn't be in the business of trying to reallocate power between political parties, so we're not going to get involved, is basically what they said.
And in your view, and you've written extensively about it, and we're going to talk in a minute about a new study that you're going to have out shortly, is that the right approach for the court to take?
I would say yes. It's certainly the right approach that is consistent with where they've been in the past, and it's certainly consistent with the longer constitutional and legislative history on the subject. Gerrymandering in at least some form has been with us since the early days of the Republic. Clearly, the founders regarded it as acceptable to a certain degree, And to the extent that they prescribed remedies for it, they basically said this is for state legislatures and Congress to deal with. So the Constitution says very specifically states draw the districts, state legislatures draw the districts, and the Congress can come in and make or alter the rules for drawing the districts as it chooses. And over the years, Congress has done that in various ways. There are various requirements in federal apportionment acts that dictate how states may and may not draw their district boundaries. For the court to come in and say, well, now we're going to say what's an acceptable map and what isn't, would have been a pretty considerable departure from the last 200-plus years of the way this has been looked at.
In terms of the fact that Congress, as you've just mentioned, has weighed in over the years and said, you must do this, you must do that, particularly the Congress has weighed in to try to increase minority representation, majority-minority districts, you have that as a sort of gerrymandering, is it not?
Well, this is an excellent point, because I think a lot of people think of gerrymandering through one particular lens or another. Some people, when they think of gerrymandering, they think of racially discriminatory gerrymandering. Some people think of gerrymandering basically to achieve adequate representation for minority groups that otherwise wouldn't have it if the districts weren't gerrymandered to a certain degree. Other people think of gerrymandering as one party moving against another party to get political advantage. And this is important because there are a lot of different reasons why legislative district shapes might be odd. And they don't all have to do with whether one party is trying to gain advantage over another party. There's a lot of different reasons why district shapes might not be perfectly regular. And framing the gerrymandering question solely as a political balancing act, a partisan balancing act, as I think some have tried to do in putting this before the courts, really misses a lot of the subtleties that go on with respect to how these districts are drawn.
So to some degree, gerrymandering is in the eyes of the beholder?
I think that's very much the case. And again, I think there's a bit of a gap between how the public at large thinks of it and how a certain sort of nerd community or activist community, if you will, thinks of it. I think there has been a mushrooming interest of late in trying to recruit the courts. These various activity groups have tried to recruit the courts to reform what they consider to be gerrymandering, which is the drawing of districts to be politically imbalanced, and they want to recruit the courts to draw them in to fulfill their political objectives. But I don't think that's the way the person on the street really thinks about it. I think the person on the street thinks about it is, look, here's this really oddly shaped district. Why is that? And that's why I believe that a better route to reform is to simply constrain the irregularity allowed of district map making rather than recruiting the courts to try to strike a particular partisan balance.
We have been talking with Charles Blahaus, who is a senior research strategist with the Mercatus Center, which of course is at George Mason University, talking about gerrymandering and the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision. Charles, if we have listeners who would like to read your article, read your upcoming study, learn more about this, tell us a bit about Mercatus and where can they go to read this information?
Well, Mercatus is an academic research center. We're affiliated with George Mason University. We have a website, www.mercatus.org. You can find my most recent article there, and you'll be able to find my upcoming study there in a couple of weeks when it's published.
Charles Blahaus of the Mercatus Center. Charles, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
At the offices of the Club for Growth, we have Scott Parkinson standing by. Scott, good to talk with you again.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Well, there was some action in Congress on immigration. We're going to get to that in a minute. But in the interim, our old friend, and I use that term very loosely, Colin Kaepernick, has once again spurted into the headlines, having nothing to do with football. There's yet another flag controversy, and of course it involves Nike. So set the stage for us, Scott.
Well, I think most of your listeners know and remember who Colin Kaepernick is and what he did other than beating the Green Bay Packers in the playoffs one year. So Colin Kaepernick has repeatedly protested the national anthem by kneeling before the flag, and this ultimately resulted in him having a hard time reaching a new contract to play in the National Football League. So Colin Kaepernick has pretty much been out of the spotlight on Sundays for the last several years, but he's become a political icon to the far left for his protests. Certainly the fundamental theme that he's protesting, we can have a discussion about, but the manner in which he is protesting, kneeling before the flag, caught a lot of criticism, especially from President Trump heading into the 2016 elections. And he's back in the news again this week. Nike, everybody has probably a pair of Nike shoes or shorts, or maybe you got a Nike basketball. They've got major manufacturing within the United States and all over the world. And what happened here was Nike was going to have a brand new shoe that featured the Betsy Ross flag. And Colin Kaepernick had a problem with that. He said that it was offensive to have this flag on a Nike shoe. So Nike said that they would go ahead and cease production of the shoe following Colin Kaepernick's criticism. And so what resulted this week was Arizona's Governor Doug Ducey put out a thread of tweets that I think really warrant everybody's attention, all your listeners' attention. And he breaks down what happened here and makes a brand new announcement. Actually, Nike was supposed to be relocating some of its business to Goodyear, Arizona. And the governor has gone forward and canceled this work with Nike and canceled the incentive contracts that they would have used in order to bring the relocation of Nike's business to the state. So on one hand, you've got a lot of governors compete with each other through these incentive deals. It's how we get Amazon to come to Virginia. It's how some governors get, you know, the major business to come to Illinois instead of Wisconsin. There are tax incentives that they can offer that ultimately lower the corporate tax liability of a corporation. And that's how states can really compete with each other. What we want here at the Club for Growth, obviously, is a free market system. And that's why I'm really proud of what Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona has done. He talks about how our system of government and free enterprise have allowed them, meaning Nike, to prosper and flourish. And instead of celebrating American history during the week of our nation's independence, Nike has decided that Betsy Ross is unworthy, and so Doug Ducey has decided that Nike is unworthy of this incentive deal in the state of Arizona. It'll, in the end, cause other American businesses to relocate to Arizona because they know that having a revisionist history that shames Betsy Ross, of all people, is wrong, and I think that Doug Ducey should be commended for what he's done.
Well, he certainly should. And Nike, of course, a huge disappointment as a company, obviously operated by a bunch of wusses who just bend to political correctness at every point. And they've done it once again. So kudos to Governor Ducey and what he's done. We only have a couple of minutes left here, Scott, but I did want to touch on immigration. This was a big issue as we headed into the last couple of days of Congress being in session before breaking for the Independence Day holiday. They did finally approve some money to assist with the flood of illegal aliens who are coming across the southern border. It has got, of all people, Senator Schumer in the crosshairs. So what's up with that?
Yeah, so you may recall that the Senate overwhelmingly passed legislation to provide additional funding for our border security and to deal with the humanitarian crisis in the southern border. There was nearly $4.6 billion that would have been provided. And this legislation passed the Senate 84-8. So they kicked it over to the House, and the House ultimately had to eat the legislation because the House passed legislation prior to the Senate bill was done across party lines, and none of the Republicans really supported that. I say none, but I think that there were three that voted with the Democrats. So it didn't have the support in the Senate. Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell came together with a deal and killed the House bill, passed the Senate bill, and really forced Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrat majority to take what the Senate product overwhelmingly passed. In the end, the House bill did pass 305-102, but it really split the Democrats in half. You only had 129 Democrats voting yes, 95 voting no, and then the Republicans, it was 176 voting yes and 7 voting no. So what did the legislation do? It provided supplemental appropriations for fiscal year 2019 to address the border-related funding caused by the recent spike in border crossings along the southern border. This was ultimately $4.58 billion dollars, and that's going to go directly to humanitarian aid to help basically fund this crisis and ensure that those that are working to have a humanitarian response on the southern border, our Border Patrol and Immigration Customs Enforcement, that they have the ability to address the crisis. Obviously, President Trump signed this bill into law.
Okay, we will continue to keep an eye on immigration, which, needless to say, is far from resolved. But in the meantime, Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
So the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members from all across the country, including all 50 states in the union. Our organization is united because we believe in economic freedom. And if your listeners are interested, they can check us out on our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. I'd also encourage everybody to check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The efficiency of your next kitchen dishwasher might be considerably less if the Department of Energy is successful in implementing new regulations. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Devin Watkins at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
We don't think a lot about our dishwashers. I mean, if you're like me, you just love that it's there so that you don't have to scrub all your pots and pans and plates by hand. But if you think that your dishwasher today takes longer to go through a full cycle than it did 10 or 20 years ago, well, it's not your imagination. You're not just going crazy. That's actually true. And it's in large part due to some regulations that are continually updated by the Federal Department of Energy. But those regulations are now subject to a challenge. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal, and let me be probably the last to wish you a happy 4th of July and happy Independence Day. My guest today is Devin Watkins. He's an attorney with the Competitive Enterprise Institute here in Washington, D.C. CEI, they do some really great work fighting the regulatory state on all sorts of fronts in ways that you would never really think of, including in this case on regulations dealing with dishwashers. Devin, thanks so much for taking some time and joining us to tell us about this.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Before we get into the specifics here, Devin, the specifics of what CEI is trying to do, let's start with the background, the regulations themselves. Why can't I just buy a dishwasher that gets my dishes clean as quickly as I want it to?
Well, not maybe as clean as you might want. There are a lot of regulations that have been added, and they become more and more stringent. This really originally happened during kind of the energy crisis about 30 years ago or so. And these regulations were put in place, I think, with good intentions. They were designed to try to limit the amount of energy that appliances used at first. And the idea was if we reduce the amount of energy, then we're less reliant on foreign oil and whatnot and things like that. But the problem was, as over time, as these regulations became more and more stringent, they started to impact the consumer performance, whether it is the amount of cleanliness that the dishwashers can do, or in our case, what we were talking about is the cycle time, how long the dishwasher takes to clean the dishes.
So the Department of Energy says that a dishwasher can't use more than a certain amount of energy. And that is why it's using too much electricity. It's using too much water. Is it creating global warming somehow? What's their rationale here?
So in this case, the Department of Energy is setting the maximum amount of energy and the maximum amount of water that can be used. And while their regulations are per year, they predict a certain number of cycles per year. So really the regulations are about how much energy and water can be used each cycle that the dishwasher runs. And so as you constrain the amount of energy and water usage, the ability for the dishwasher to actually get the dishes clean is impacted. It's made worse. And many of the manufacturers have responded to that by increasing the amount of time that it takes to clean the dishes so that hopefully they get closer to actually being cleaned.
Right, right. So if it wasn't for these regulations, you could have dishwashers that did the same amount of work in less time. You guys at CEI now, you guys are challenging these regulations. Tell us a little bit about what you're trying to do.
We went back and looked at the cycle times that had been occurring for dishwashers. And what we found was that every time the Department of Energy had made these standards more stringent, the amount of time that the dishwasher took per cycle increased. And this had happened regularly over the last 30 years as the standards become more and more stringent. And so what we did is we proposed to the Department of Energy that we create a new class of dishwashers, dishwashers that can clean and dry dishes in under an hour. We don't eliminate any of the current dishwashers that are on the market. The only thing we do is try to give the consumers another option. If they want dishwashers that can clean and dry dishes quickly, that is something that manufacturers should be allowed to provide them.
That sounds good to me. Sounds pretty good. We are talking to Devin Watkins. He is an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and we are talking about these Department of Energy regulations, regulations that have been on the books for decades. This is not a Trump-era thing or an Obama-era thing. These go way back, and they limit your choices as a consumer when it comes to buying a dishwasher. Devin, just about a minute left here, but I'm always kind of fascinated by how complicated it is to make even small changes to the federal regulatory state. So if you'll indulge me for a second, give me a sense of how this is all going to play out. As I understand it, you guys got a fairly significant victory this week, but there's still a lot to come here.
We submitted our petition last year, and the DOE then put it into the Federal Register and let anyone that wanted to comment on it to comment on our petition. We got about 2,300 comments, of which I think about 90% were from individuals and were supportive of our petition. And after that kind of avalanche of consumer support, the DOE yesterday granted our petition. And so they will be starting the process of changing the rules for dishwashers. It's going to be a two-cycle process. They're going to go through the first regulatory process where they will establish the new class of dishwashers, and then they will go through a second process where they set the amount of energy and water that we require for that new class.
Yeah, the amount of time and effort that it takes just to let people buy the type of dishwasher they want is kind of amazing. But that's why we are so glad to have folks like you, Devin, and your colleagues at CEI who have the time and the energy necessary, honestly, to make this stuff happen. Thanks so much for taking some time and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, that is Devin Watkins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's an attorney at CEI, and you can read more about their efforts to change the Department of Energy regulations for dishwashers at CEI.org. Lots of other good stuff going on at CEI as well. And of course, check out our coverage of regulations and everything else involving the federal regulatory state at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
A new American restoration is possible if the country embraces several core strategies that would help heal the political divisions we now face. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In this week of the annual celebration of our nation's birth, it's a good time to think about who we really are and where we are really going. There's a polarization in our country today that is greater than anything I've seen in my life, including the very troubled 1960s. The management guru and author Ken Blanchard recently offered this sobering assessment. We are increasingly separated into two warring win-lose camps. With both major political parties seemingly devoted to regarding the other as irredeemable and to obliterating it to the extent possible, are we on the path to self-destruction, or is there a legitimate basis for the hope of restoration? I'm pleased to say that my good friend Tim Gagline has written a new book, released just this week, which promises exactly that. It's called American Restoration, co-written with Craig Austin. The book's subtitle sets forth its basic premise, how faith, family, and personal sacrifice can heal our nation. This book is not merely worth reading in its own right, but because of its extensive use of quotations from a wide range of writers, journalists, political leaders, and social analysts. Reading it gives you a virtual survey course of more than two centuries of the greatest Western minds opining on why America remains unique among all nations for the way it articulates a set of civic virtues and then integrates them into a system of government. The authors don't shy away from acknowledging the many shortfalls between our ideals and our performance as a society, but they do hold a generally optimistic view of the future. If we can rediscover and then reconnect personally and sincerely with the values and ideals of our founders, rooted in faith but not exclusively religious, then we will stop sliding further away and begin once again to come together. The authors believe that faith in God is one of the most important pillars of society, not just a constitutionally protected freedom. That protected freedom is the freedom not only to hold, but also to express beliefs about God which may well be out of the cultural mainstream. President Obama had a habit of referring to the freedom to worship as if it were the same thing as religious freedom, which of course it is not. The formal practice of worship is but a part of the much larger concept of faith in God, so equating the two is to diminish the scope of religious freedom. Faith in God at its deepest also compels a level of humility that facilitates a civil society. Therefore, to restore America, we must restore respect for any and all forms of religious beliefs. In my religious tradition of Christianity, the term most often used for that kind of restoration is revival. To restore America, we should pray for a new revival that will sweep across our land. It has happened before in America, and it can happen again, although I suspect that the next revival will be quite different from the great awakenings of the 18th and 19th centuries. The second major pillar of society that must be restored if America is to be restored, according to Gegline and Austin, is the family. They state it succinctly when they say, "The breakdown of the institutions of marriage and family harms all other relationships, crippling the ability for society to operate smoothly." The third major pillar of a healthy and peaceful society is the network of small associations, noticed first by de Tocqueville and made famous by Edmund Burke as the little platoons, as he called them, of neighborhood groups, churches, volunteers, community associations, and the like. They are an important part of the fabric of American society that has no parallel in other cultures. While technology substitutes digital interaction for human interaction, there are signs already that our younger generations are beginning to shun the impersonality of texts and social media as they recognize intuitively that they're missing something. The book closes by urging us not to despair. The key to America's restoration is found in remaining engaged in our neighborhoods, in our communities, and in our nation, doing so faithfully and knowing God is in control. We must look toward the examples of selfless sacrifice and emulate them in our own lives, rather than fence ourselves off from the world. The challenge will be great, but if we are bold and successful, a new American Renaissance may await us. The book is American Restoration, and I commend it to you. It is a hopeful message at a time of great need for hope. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, WYNT-FM, WMRN-FM, and WMRN-AM in Marion, Ohio. Welcome to our new listeners in the Buckeye State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.